hearing today, public hearing on House Bill 5008, Department of Corrections. Laird, would you like to start with orientation?
Thank you, Chair Hansen. Committee members, before you today, we start the first of the 4 days scheduled for public hearings. The Chair had asked for the Department to come in and lay out a presentation format that would allow them to complete it within 4 days of hearing and then have 2 days of public testimony. So the Department, it's an aggressive plan. The Department has come up with a plan to accomplish that, and this is the first day. I'll be brief in my opening comments. The Department of Corrections budget is the biggest budget that this subcommittee will hear this session. It's $863 million. That's approximately half of the general fund in the public safety judicial area. This is a budget that is primarily reliant on general fund. 85% of its total budget is general fund. They do have other funds that they do use, and you'll see those in the budget there. The governor's recommended budget, it's approximately $143 million. Of other funds. Those are primarily revenues derived from the sales of certificates of participation used to finance facilities. There are some other things in there in terms of inmate welfare funds, inmate work crew revenue, Department of Education, and community colleges also provide them with some revenue for education programs, but the bulk of it's certificates of participation. You'll also see a federal funds line of approximately $10.3 million. That was the amount that was anticipated during the governor's development of his budget. It's approximately $2 million less than that ultimately, but those are state criminal alien assistance program funds that the department receives for to offset the cost of incarcerating illegal aliens. You'll see that when you look at the table I've provided to you there with the size of the budget, when you look at the differences between the current service level general fund and the governor's recommended general fund, you see that the department's budget is down about $64.5 million. From the current service level budget, and they'll talk about during their presentation the steps that were taken to develop the budget that do result in a reduction. When you compare the general fund 9901 estimated to the governor's recommended, you will see that in spite of that CSL reduction, current service level reduction, you'll see that the budget does overall increase in general fund approximately $100 million from $762.9 million to $863 million. So there is growth, primarily driven by startup and increasing cost of phase-in of beds. In terms of giving you a perspective on FTE, they have about 3,800 FTE, and we got a forecast of about 10,000 inmates. Where the funds are spent, that table at the bottom just gives you a perspective on the budget units. You're going to see that they've got approximately 8 budget units, the largest of which is institutions. And at about 46% of their budget. This budget is largely driven by personal services costs and expenses. You'll see in institutions, for instance, they've got about 80% of the FTE in the entire department are in the institution's budget, around 3,091. And personal services expenses are about between 77 and 80% of their overall budget expenses. So a lot of things depend on staffing plans, deployment of staff, creation of 5-day, 7-day posts. A lot of things are driven by how they operate the institutions. This is a department budget that does rebalance at least once each biennium. This last one, there was two rebalances, and we'll talk about what happened at those rebalances as we go through the units. I would just tell you that regardless of what happens at those rebalances, the funds return to whatever budgeted areas they were in. So if they had an overexpenditure in an area because of health services, for instance, had an overexpenditure, and they move money from one area to another to deal with that, the rebalance happens, the funds are moved, but at the budget development, they're returned. So it's like the whole, whatever was once fixed is not permanently fixed. So you'll see that pattern show up.
As Mr. Chair, as you do the rebudgeting, then even though they rebalanced and moved monies between parts of the budget, when you actually at the end, it all goes back to where it had been originally when you figure what the next budget's going to be based on in terms of the base? Is that what you're saying?
Chair Hansen, Senator Trill, that's correct. The only way they would avoid that is if they did the rebalance before the April picks freeze and budget development period starts. Right,
but they have the ability, if they see clearly that there are needs one place rather than another, to make that allocation themselves in the budget, right?
Chair Hansen, Senator Trill, if they see the need to move money from, they have, their appropriation bill has groupings. For instance, institution correction programs are together. If they need to move money from outside of that grouping, they would have to come to the emergency board to do that. Otherwise, they have latitude within the groupings that their appropriation bill sets out.
Even when they're preparing a new budget?
When they're preparing a new budget, if they want to move funds from one area to another based on expenditure patterns or otherwise, they would have to do some adjustment packages in their budget development, either through essential packages or 090 reduction packages to permanently move funds.
Even though they had rebalanced that way, they still would have to do.
That's okay. Correct. The department had 15, the page set 2 of my handout starts talking to you a little bit about where the growth is overall, and I just wanted you to see that from the chart. This is total funds, and it totals up more than the $100 million we talked about earlier because that was just general fund. But just in general, just so you know, when you're looking at the various budget units, the magnitude of the growth. Institutions budget overall goes up about $68 million from 9901 expenditures. Community corrections, $20 million. Correctional program, $17 million. So, you know, I just, in perspective, you'll hear a lot about cuts, you'll hear a lot about reductions, but, you know, overall some of these areas do have total funding increases due to the phasing in of Two Rivers facility, due to the startup of the Coffee Creek intake facility, primarily. There were 15 budget notes last session 2 years ago, and I've given you copies of those. The department will try to weave those responses to those, at least updates on what they've done in response to those in their presentation. If not, we'll double back and talk about those at the end. Some of them required interim reports, and I've also placed before you copies of the audit reports that were completed during the last 2 years. Both of them relate to prison construction and bidding processes. I would encourage you to take a chance to look at those. The department's budget notebook also talks about their response to the audit on change order management and subcontractor bidding, and there's stuff in your notebook helps you with that. As I indicated before, they have come to the emergency board for rebalances. In total, in the last interim, they came in 11 times for various reports primarily, but there were 2 rebalance plans. In terms of the governor's budget, the issues you're going to hear about over the next 4 days, there are some things in the governor's budget that require significant changes in how correctional programs are delivered. They are closing some activities down. They're closing some exercise yards. There are some significant changes that would have to be implemented in order for them to live with the funding level provided. Issues that have been brought to staff's attention through members and other interested parties that will probably be a focus of some discussion relate to spans of control, management structure, staff deployment plans, timing of construction, the COP sales, use of temporary beds, and I wasn't sure of how much this came up, but there was in order to really change anything in terms of the long-range plan construction timing, you have to look at policy changes, and there would be need to be law changes if you were going to do anything related to transfers of youth, is my understanding, at least if you were to mandate it. If you're also to significantly change the timing of phase-in of facilities, you'd almost have to look at ballot measure 11 and good time, because the population forecast is driven by length of stay, and with ballot measure 11, they are mandatory sentences, and there aren't the opportunities to release early. So those are the things I'm, in terms of letting you know, as you requested up front, things that I'm looking at as staff as we're looking at the budget. We're looking at how it's built, the budget execution, the use of position authority, the population management plan, the timing of construction, COP sales. Those are the primary ones, and then reviewing priorities for restoration or enhancement should we have the opportunity. I've attached a copy of the write-up for the department. I hope you've had a chance to review it beforehand, but if you've lost your copy, I've given you another one. And as I indicated going in, the department's here today to provide their overview, and we'll get as far as we can.
Extraordinary. Thank you. Any comments before we end the presentation?
Welcome, and please proceed.
Chair Miller, members of the committee, I'm Dave Cook, Director of the Department of Corrections. I'm going to take us through the overview, and then as we move ahead through the next several days, you're going to hear more specific information from several of the divisions, which we'll focus upon. In terms of agency mission, we have, I think, pretty consistently said for some number of years now that our mission is not just simply running institutions, but doing what we can to ensure the public safety as well. 97% of our inmates do return to the community, and the average sentence currently is about 37 months. The effective incarceration requires a high degree of accountability, certainly to ensure that inmates return to the community, understanding what their role is when they return. We operate with a respectful environment from our expectation of the inmates and expect the same in return, in a sense allowing them to practice for return to the community if they're going to be successful. The effective programs in DOC focus upon what's known as criminogenic needs, just essentially those sorts of things that allow people to live appropriately, being drug-free, having a housing location that's permanent, having employment, having family support, things of that nature address those issues that allow people to sort of wander off the path towards criminality. The last piece that we've been working on pretty diligently over the last couple of years has been an effort to ensure, knowing that 97% of these folks do return, is thinking more about the transition, about the reentry. How is that done in such a way that inmates are prepared, the community's prepared, the systems are in place, and that's accomplished in a way that lowers the chance that people will reoffend. Agency goals are really broken into two separate kinds of activities. One is sort of the overall strategic goal, the vision of the organization, sort of the high-level policy piece. And then since 1995, when Ben DeHaan and I came and a number of other people came to the Department of Corrections, it's the more operational 24-month planning process. We've run this by, I think, most legislators over the course of the last 6 years, really talking about how the department plans. That 24-month plan has really been the way that we have operationalized a lot of our change in the most recent biennia. One of our strategic goals has been to sort of broaden our role in the area of criminal justice and public safety, not just see ourselves as prison operations or community corrections, but think more broadly about the role that we play in a systems approach to doing business and public safety. We've made, I think, a pretty concerted effort to increase collaboration, and that's been done broadly. Some good examples, for example, yesterday or the day before, I guess now, more work with victims, something the department had not been doing for a number of years. We're now more engaged in with the victims' groups. Victim notification just was brought about recently in a partnership with the Department of Justice, DOC, and a number of victims' groups. And that's going to have, I think, a pretty immediate and pretty positive effect on how much victims know about where the criminals who created the havoc for them are located when they transfer, when they're released, a number of other things that people worry about when they've been the victim. They want to know what the result of that offender's status is. Business community, natural resource agencies, a number of other areas where we've been involved in private-public partnerships with folks to lower the cost of government, increase the amount of work done in Deschutes National Forest or whatever the case might be. We're in those businesses with those partners. We've focused much more on outcomes, delivering programs, delivering other kinds of services that have measurable outcomes to them. Well, I'll talk more about that in just a few minutes. IT, our information technology resources, are focused on decision making. How do you go about knowing what works, what's effective, what makes a difference with those inmates that will return to communities? And the IT piece is focused around us being able to do that. And then one of the big issues for us has been the preparation for future leaders. We started a leadership development program several years ago. It's been one of the most, I think, well-received internal pieces of training that we've ever done. As we've grown rapidly in the last couple of years, it's been pretty apparent that if we don't develop the leaders, the future leaders of the organization, we will not be successful. And we are now putting that class out to virtually anybody who's interested in the department. It includes represented folks, non-represented, the managers, the executive team. Everybody is engaged in that training process of leadership development. The strategic business plan process, as I said earlier, is really broken into sort of a two-year chunk process. We upgrade that every 6 months. We take the highlighted items that we want to really focus our attention on and do a double check on where we are and where we're headed. A good example of some of the things that we've done to augment that 24-month plan is to do longer-term planning around such things as population management and the long-range prison construction process. I'm sorry, I'm actually synopsizing what's in the overview.
Are you on any page of the overview?
Yes, sir. I'm on
page 3.
I'm on page 3, I think, is where I'll be.
Strategic business plan.
Yeah, strategic business plan, okay. And moving through that currently. And this this business planning process can be seen as dating back to essentially 1995, when we began sort of looking at where the department was and what needed to be done to drive it towards dealing with issues that were going to be arising, facing us in the future. There are six major areas of concentration in that planning process that I think you'll find in front of you. Inmate transition, which I spoke a little bit about earlier, that has become not only important in Oregon, and Oregon's actually assisting and driving the process nationwide, where some of our plans and our ideas are being talked about it at from Washington, D.C. to national conferences around transition because of some things that we're looking at. The leadership development, again, that is one of those areas that that we can't be successful without doing the work. The work doesn't exist anyplace else in this state for us to take advantage of, so we designed it internally and run it internally. The inmate management and transition system, the IMATS, which you'll hear a good deal more about later, is really a focus on efficiency in the organization, knowing that we've got to control costs and at the same time deliver the goods to the inmates that we have a responsibility for. That system will be talked about in detail later, but it is one of the primary focuses of our 24-month planning process. Another area that under Governor's executive order, and I think most state agencies have talked about, is sustainability and resource efficiency. The department is one of the state leaders in that area. We've been invited to speak in the next month about what our efforts have been in that area, whether it's reduction of electrical consumption or recycling efforts or using waste stream to lower our costs in some way. We have done a lot of work in that area, primarily led by our physical plant managers, people with a real interest in it, a knowledge about it, and they are sort of the champions for the department to improve its efficiency and lower its waste stream and costs that result from processing that waste stream. Business profitability, whether it's within the department, the work crews that we operate, and other things we do on behalf of communities or other needy parties that use our service, or the Oregon Corrections Enterprise system, that independent, semi-independent state agency that was broken off in the last biennium. And then finally, new prison construction and activation. That has been part of the planning process essentially from the beginning in 95, recognizing that we were going to face, for the Oregon system, unprecedented growth in terms of criminals coming into the system. One of the major processes that we focused on is how do you go about siting, constructing, making more efficient, lowering the cost of things of that nature, the building process. I am now moving to the agency organization piece, and you'll find that on page 4. I want to show you a pie chart here. I hope that's visible to you. You may want to move that up if necessary. With my glasses on, I can make it out. But essentially what we're trying to convey there is information Larry has already, I think, provided to you. But in essence, what you will see is that the major focus of our presentation to you and the dollars invested in the Department of Corrections are focused in really two areas, program and institution. We're not going to go into, unless you request it, a lot of detail in other areas. For example, the all others, the infrastructure support to running the Department of Corrections. That portion of the budget is actually declined from this year, this biennium, to next biennium. So our focus will be on that, program area, community corrections, and institutions. The divisions are in your book, and I don't think I need to repeat them, but we'll cover all of them, just not in the detail. We'll cover the major division issues. I want to next put up the inmate population chart for you, if I can, just to give you a little idea about, before I launch into the programs and services piece, which you'll find also on page 4, that is the both the actual population and the projected population for the Department of Corrections through the year 2005. And while you're looking at that,
Senator Trow has a question.
Dave, is there any slowdown in the number of Measure 11 people coming through, or do we continue to incarcerate a lot of prisoners who are Measure 11 prisoners?
Chair Miller, Senator Trow, the intake currently from month to month would indicate that the ballot Measure 11 population is essentially half of all the intake inmates. So we continue to grow in terms of the ballot Measure 11 population in the institutions.
Is that increasing then the length of stay, the average length of stay over time?
Chair Miller, Senator Trow, yes it is.
Senator Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dave, I've been out of the prison population field for a while. I just a couple questions. In terms of inmate population, what percentage of this population is now women? And are the number of women inmates rising in Oregon at the same rate they're rising at the national level?
Chair Miller, Senator Brown, the number of women in the system, the percentage of women in the system, is actually growing at a more rapid rate than it is for men, but they still represent a very small percentage, and I would guess that to be somewhere around 6.5% or so. We can get you the exact number, but that's approximate. As it relates to nationwide trends, I think Oregon is probably not significantly different than other states. The female offender population is rising at a rapid rate, but they still historically, and I think in the future, will represent a less significant, well, obviously the lesser number of inmates by gender.
Thanks.
You're welcome.
Next wonder.
Just in follow-up to Senator Trow's question on about Measure 11 offenders, there, I think it's about 23% of the population in the prisons is there, and growth is because of that. And the future growth, about half of it, is projected to be related to ballot Measure 11 specifically. So length of sentence is increasing the population.
It's about, Ben is indicating that in current data, it suggests that it's about one-third of the current population is ballot Measure 11 offenders. But at 50% intake, at some point, you see that that's going to be fairly equitable.
Is there any evidence that ballot Measure 11 is acting as a deterrent in keeping people from offending so that we are slowing down the crime rate because of it?
Chair Miller, Senator Trow, I think there are a lot of beliefs about those kinds of sentencing practices. I don't happen to personally believe that it acts as a deterrent for people who are intoxicated and drug influenced, things like that, to say, well, you know, maybe I won't do this because of the consequences. Swift, certain punishment, the kinds of things that Oregon is then driving towards have more effect. But there are people who firmly believe that ballot Measure 11 works, and it's probably tough to contest either side of that argument.
Is there a huge percentage of these folks who basically their offense is drug-related?
Chair Miller, Senator Trow, no, their offense is not drug-related. Their behavior is dictated by drug and alcohol addiction or affliction, yes. Oregon incarcerates about, and that's what I was going to go to next, is basically inmate demographics. You see the numbers, but that doesn't really tell you much about who these people are in kind of a general way. 75% of that number you see on the board there, now and in the future, will be person-to-person offenders. These are people who are preying upon others in a physical assault, murder to rape to assault. 55% of them are serving longer than 5 years. More than half are serving more than 5 years. 95% of them return to counties in western Oregon, and about half the prison population now is east of the Cascades. 84% of those assessed at our intake process have less than a GED in terms of their educational level. 18% of them have serious mental health issues, and that continues to grow. As we've reported over the last several biennia in our budget presentations, that number ticks up every biennia by a percentage point or two. And finally, 70, and this is a little squishy, because it's squishy in the jails and most systems, between 70, and I've always used 75% as kind of a norm, but between 75 and 80% are drug or alcohol afflicted in some way, seriously or in some way incapacitated by their addiction or usage.
Chair, do you have those details?
Those details, sir, are not in your booklet, but we can provide that demographic information. I just inserted it as sort of an update on what the population looks like.
Very interesting material. Yes, Senator Brown.
Mr. Chair, Dave, if we can get the demographic information, can we also get the breakdown via race?
Yes.
And I assume we're still facing an overrepresentation of minorities in our correction system.
Chair Miller, Senator Brown, yes, we are. The program services area, correctional programs and institutions, we're going to cover all of these in detail over the next several days in our four-day presentation. Those are all, I think, pretty apparent to you, traditionally the things that we have run, including workforce development, health, intake and assessment, that kind of process. And then the final chart I think we're going to use this morning is going to give you just a reference map of where the institutions are located around the state of Oregon. The legend 1 through 14 shows you the existing or under construction facilities, including Coffee Creek in the Washington County area, and then four additional prisons, 15 through 18, are the future proposed institutions in Junction City, Lakeview, Madras, and White City. And just if you're thinking about sort of where things are going on, this will give you some picture of it. Obviously concentrated in the Salem metropolitan area and in the core of the valley to Portland. The next page that I'm moving to is page 5, Major Program Changes and Reorganization. Just a little history here. I came to the Department of Corrections in July of 1995. And I actually didn't know what I was getting myself into. You know, when you look back at that time, it all looked very interesting and exciting, and it's been every bit of that. But there has been a lot of change that's gone on during that time. I think many of you will remember that post-ballot Measure 11, there were expectations of seeing 19,000 prisoners in Oregon's prisons. We were driven to site and build prisons at a relatively rapid rate. A lot of that's changed. The effect of the system has moderated that growth. The projection you saw earlier would indicate that growth has slowed. That doesn't mean that it has not been a traumatic change for the Department of Corrections. I mean, any business that grows at the rate that we've grown over the last several biennia has gone through those kinds of changes. On top of that, ballot Measure 11 effects, on top of the growth, came ballot Measure 17. Which required that all inmates work essentially as hard as the taxpayers who support them. And we came, Ben, Sue Acuff, a number of us came to the department to deal with these issues and you know, deliver the goods to the voters that required them. One of the things that we were benefited by was an opportunity in 95 to have an external management review of the organization sort of tell us from a objective point of view what is it that needs to be done to deal with the department as it currently exists, a department that historically had a very high reputation around the country for the performance of its correctional duties, but had some other management issues that were not going particularly well at the time, and that was really the focus of the review. Some things that we've done since then, personnel, labor relations, and other functions like that, we've incorporated into a human resources division. Sort of brought all that together using what we believe to be the right strategies to address those kinds of concerns. Planning for prison expansion and construction and consolidating that in a business and finance division. We organized all the programs into a single program office, trying to get at, as I mentioned earlier, the criminogenic needs, the outcome measures, things of that type, to ensure that we didn't have programs sort of haphazardly coming about around the Department of Corrections, but coming about with a strategy. We've enhanced our areas of research activity into a single division, looking at what the best practices are and what the sort of outcome opportunities were there. Prison industries were changed dramatically during last biennium to the Oregon Corrections Enterprises System, that semi-independent state agency that I have responsibility for as the CEO of that as well, but done in a completely different way than it had been historically done in the department. And then finally, things like the Inspections Division, Community Corrections, and the Office of Public Affairs were under the Director's Office. More control over sort of how that all came about and less less parsing out of those responsibilities. I'm going to move to performance and outcome measures next, talk a little bit about that and give you an overview of that. I think that made it into your packet, and I'll try to explain a little bit about what we've done there. Oregon, as most of you I know, has been a leader in trying to deal with the performance management management and measurement issues since the first part of the 70s, the benchmarking process, things of that nature. The correction system has essentially one benchmark, and that is recidivism. And historically, that measure has been the sole way that DOC has been measured. We took it upon ourselves to explore some other opportunities. In particular, Ben DeHaan's been very involved in this, working with a number of people around the country and internal to the state of Oregon to try to develop models that would work for us, to give the department some opportunities to look at how they do business and in a real-world sort of way measure our performance in those areas. There are currently 28 different individual performance measures that we've created, everything from how do you run safe and secure institutions, ensure that your staff are safe, the community is safe, and that inmates are safe, how do you have a safe and healthy workplace, how do you do business planning, and things of those natures. We address them in seven general areas with 28 specific measures. And they're in various stages of development. Some of them are still in the debate stage. Others are in a much more acceptable state for people to respond to. In 0103, part of our goal will be to more fully automate these kinds of activities and to have them available to our staff as well as to the general public. And I think you'll find on your page, I believe it's on your page, the website that will have all of these measures. So at any given point, if you're thinking about what's the Department of Corrections up to today, any citizen can dial up and see where we are in terms of our performance. I'm going to show you two specific ones that are I think pretty directly at the heart of what we do. One is, how much illicit drug activity is there in the Department of Corrections? How much access to drugs do inmates have? After all, if 70 to 80% of them have that particular issue at the heart of their criminal behavior, then how well do we control the illicit flow of those into our institutions? We have been, and we have touted this for the last 4 years, the lowest illicit drug activity in the country. We run a very tight ship in that regard. But now we have a more direct way to sort of convey that message. And what we've done is use what we call the dashboard approach to this. The kind of thing that if somebody who doesn't know much about corrections wants to get on the website and see, you know, what are these guys up to, it's a very explicit measurement of our performance. For example, the illicit drug activity, the drug use. And this is done by random analysis on a monthly basis of a select number of inmates, over 500 generally. The line is the target. The line you see on that dashboard, the straight black line, is the target. That target is less than, it's 0.5% random drug use measurement in a given month. The needle is the current behavior in the last month of where we are in doing that random testing on inmates. And the dot is essentially the average over the last 12 months. So you can see that we have what we consider to be a very, very low target, 0.5% on random urinalysis. In fact, we've been below that number. We occasionally will have spikes, and you'll see that speedometer needle jump above the target, but on average over the last 12 months we've maintained that at 0.4%. The next one measures another thing that's interesting, I think, to most voters, and that is our performance in inmate work. The line is obviously the target. We've told the legislature and everybody who wants to talk about this that our goal is to have 75% of all inmates working 40 hours a week in compliance with the law, working and/or programming. Our current activity would suggest that we have 83% of all the inmates engaged in that activity in compliance of the law, and that the average over the last 12 months is actually a little less than that at 82.8. These are two of the 28 benchmarks or outcome measures that we have addressed, and we'll continue to add to that if we think that it's important and it's a way to drive performance. Those become part of each manager's responsibility. If they have these performance measures, we can measure them individually in their performance plans as well, and they know that part of their job is to reduce on-site workplace injuries, things of that nature. We can measure that both system-wide and measure it internally to their particular division. This will be a race as to whether or not my voice gives out first when we get through this. Work here, I think. The cost control activities. I want to talk just briefly about some things that we've done recently. That wasn't a request, Senator. I just.
All right.
Okay. Thank
usually
you very much.
Senator Crowe jumps
right.
up.
Thank
that
you.
Moment.
I was thinking about
by grasping
and reading the material.
Thank you very much. One of the things that we've done is our distribution center that most of you pass by on probably not a daily basis, but see occasionally right along I-5, the old. Wear-Mart facility, that will reduce cost to the DOC by efficiency more than $5 million, we expect. Lessons learned after each one of the constructions at our work at Snake River, our work at Umatilla on Two Rivers, what we do at Coffee Creek, we will essentially debrief in a very formal way the building of those institutions. And we will learn by our work with construction managers, with other sorts of people, building codes division, how we can increase the efficiency, reduce the cost, lower the time to construct, do things like that, and we do those on every one of our projects. Some of that we were working on, some of it came about due to audit activity. This is sort of a learn-as-you-go process, and that's one of those areas that I think we've learned very well how to do that, and again, we control costs doing that. Reduction in energy usage, and I mentioned that earlier about sustainability and reduction. We're good at that. We're getting better at that. We're teaching other people how to do it as well. Technology, things like video conferencing or more use of telephones. If gas goes to the predicted $3 a gallon by the summer, there'll be a lot less driving to meetings and a lot more talking in other ways, communicating in other ways to reduce those costs. It isn't necessarily the most effective way, but it gets the job done. And a good example of that is inmate misconduct hearings. Instead of putting an inmate in a vehicle and taking them someplace, which increases the risk to the public, they do it over telephone or over video link, and they do it within the scope of the law. They get their time and activity with those hearings, but at the same time, we lessen risk and we reduce cost. Growth in healthcare costs for all of us is going to be a big issue, I think, in the next several years. One of the ways we've been able to reduce that cost is to be involved in a multi-state purchasing arrangement to lower the cost of drugs. A portion of our cost, but a growing part of what it costs to do healthcare business. And then finally, the Oregon Correctional Enterprises System, they no longer are general funded. That is a sink or swim proposition with them, and they are currently swimming, although it's tough. It's tough work, and they're competing in the private sector. They're doing a number of things with inmates, teaching inmates how to be productive, working in very real-world competitive environment jobs, and providing opportunities both for inmates to work while they're incarcerated, comply with the law, and then in addition to that, get them ready for release. We are being requested to talk a little bit about the information technology systems. I don't consider myself an expert in this area, but I'll cover a couple of these, and then if there are more questions as time goes on, we'll have people that can address those. There are two particular areas of concentration, I think, for us that you probably want to know about. One is how we manage offenders, and that's a big portion of what we do with our information system. And then secondarily, how we do business support, how the $1 billion that you're going to invest is controlled and tracked and monitored. The institution management system includes inmate scheduling, Security threat group management, which is a growing concern in the Department of Corrections, and Nick will talk more about that. Central transfer issues, sentence calculation, a whole array of things that sort of get at how inmates move through the system and how they're dealt with. Ballot Measure 17 compliance is tracked in such a way, Community Corrections Information System, all the counties are engaged in that process with us as well. The business support function includes things like staff deployment, how we array staff around the institutions to provide the service that needs to be provided to inmates, and protection of our own staff and the public as well. The automated financial accounting system and human resources functions are also part of the business management system. We have a number of interfaces, although limited number of interfaces, with outside parties as well. That includes the parole board, which is sort of co-located with the Department of Corrections, community corrections at the local level, and then the courts as well, and the information of managing inmates. Essentially, the information system in DOC is one large unit centralized, and then we also have additional standalone components of that, which include the AFAMUS, the inmate trust accounts, institutional staff deployment, the other things I've mentioned, health services, and then intake and assessment of the inmates as they come into the system. And then we provide a few services as well online. And I'm now, I believe, on page 10. Those include email messaging, offender management information, extensive online forms and things of that nature, which just reduce the time it takes to do business, email and public folders, things that allow anybody out in the state or beyond to know what's going on in DOC. In addition to those performance measures, they can look that up on our website and get very, very current information in that area. And recently, it's kind of a long story and I won't go into great detail on it, but recently we had a little conversation with a motorcycle club that we had listed as a security threat group. Turns out we were wrong. And we did most of that business, most of the research, and most of the interaction with those folks over the email. We came to a very quick resolution. I think they're satisfied, we're satisfied, and it's one of those ways that people know what we're doing. They know if they want to criticize us, they can do it using that format, and we can respond to them in a way that's very, very productive. And this is an example that worked, I think, very well in this particular case. There are a couple pieces of budget-related information that you probably should know about. One, House Bill 2942 modifies the way we do grant and aid to the counties, and this is a work in progress that has been brought about because of ongoing relationship and debate with the counties about how we do this. But this is an agreed upon position, and it's moving through with House Bill 2942. House Bill 2646 is assault on a public safety officer. We in the last biennia put together a bill. I don't remember who the sponsor was, but I know both AFSCME and AOCE and DOC and others were very involved in ensuring this went through, and that was to reduce the risk to our staff by inmates propelling fluids at our officers. And that has dramatically reduced the incidence of that activity. It's made inmates much more aware, and that is a place where deterrence, I think, Senator, works. When you have inmates that are for the most part, if you're not talking about mentally ill individuals or others that are in some other way incapacitated, but the average inmate who is drug-free and thinking about the consequences of their actions, I think that behavior has been reduced by that piece of legislation. And I firmly believe that reclassifying the actual physical assault, which is now sort of a free shot for inmates against our staff, they won't propel fluids, but they'll take a punch or hit them with something else. That's a very serious concern to us, and that is also moving through the process. And then finally, House Bill 2095A deals with the way in which we contract for out-of-state facilities and services if necessary because of bed space issues. And Nick will talk more about that when he's up here if you have further concerns.
Chair Miller. Excuse me, Representative Smith.
Thank you, Chair. Can you, sometime over the course of our discussion, send me some information on the grant and aid program and how that works?
Chair Miller, Representative Smith, we certainly can. We'll have it to you. I think we can have it to you within the next several hours. So.
Chair.
I'm going to,
Senator Trow?
How long is ORS 421609 requiring you to use out-of-state facilities if they're cheaper than in-state things you might build? How long has that been in effect?
Chair Miller, Senator Trow, I think that's been in effect for two biennia? Since 97.
Are you allowed any latitude under that?
Chair Miller, Senator
facilities
Trow.
May be cheaper, but they may be a lot more riskier.
I think we can talk in more detail about it, and I'll get you the specifics on, and Sue could probably go into great detail right now if you want to hear it, but I think in essence, what we're required to do is take a look at the various costs involved, including transport, some other issues, our on-site, off-site supervision of it, things of that nature, and determine whether or not that's appropriate. I don't recall, and I shouldn't, I'll get you the information. I don't know whether the dangerousness issue or other things are taken into consideration there.
Some facilities, at least from what I read, are not terribly well run in other states. And there are lots of problems that can and have occurred.
Chair Miller, Senator Trow, I completely agree with you. I'm going to move to the affirmative action report, which is an addendum in your packet, and just synopsize that in a little way to give you a picture of where we are. I'm going to give you essentially four highlights. Females, gender in this state represent 45% of the population. In our workforce, they are approximately 32% of our workforce. I think it's probably apparent to most people that it's not only the job is tough for anybody that wants to get involved in it as a CO in particular or in other parts of working in an institution, but it's been traditionally a male role. We have grown in that area. We have moved from 17% of our CO workforce female to now 19% as we hire and build new institutions and hire new staff. Our goal is to increase that number, but we'll increase it only if we have people out there in the community that see us as an enticing place to work. And I think that's always a challenge when you're dealing with the kinds of people we deal with.
Senator Trow.
You put some women in high administrative positions, and from what I've seen, some of them have performed exceedingly well.
Well, we hope that we have some of the best leaders in state government, regardless of gender, but yes, we have. Persons of color are proportionally represented in DOC. 10% of the department's employees are people of color. State average is 9%, so we're essentially there. But that's another area where recruitment and retention are large issues, and that's part of a responsibility not just of human resources, but all the managers, all the hiring authorities to aggressively work in that particular area. This next bullet is kind of an interesting one, and I don't... I have a personal opinion about the fact that I think we need to be more aggressive about dealing with people who are disabled. And I don't think that it's impossible to have people working inside who are disabled and dealing with inmates. But we have a very small number of disabled employees, 0.7%. There are a number of areas where disabled individuals could work very successfully in the Department of Corrections. And I'm not convinced at this point that they can't work inside institutions and do that kind of work and to a degree do that now. But that's another area where we need to be more aggressive. We're far below our threshold or our target in that area.
Senator Brown?
Thanks. Dave, could you talk a little bit about specifically, I know we've got an affirmative action report attached, but could you talk specifically about what your agency is doing in terms of bringing more women into the agency, bringing more people of color into leadership, and expanding the number of people with disabilities in your workforce,
Senator
the efforts
Miller,
you're making, basically.
Senator Trow, I can talk, I think, generally about that, and we can provide you some more specifics about it. But in terms of women in the organization, a lot of that is probably word of mouth. If current female employees are successful in the DOC, we will have more females working inside our institutions and in the organization. A lot of our hiring is done in communities where people, small communities where people know each other well, and they see that working for the Department of Corrections may be a very positive thing for them, family wage opportunities, interesting work, things of that nature. But in addition to relying upon just simply word of mouth and success, We do a lot of recruitment fairs. A number of us work in college and other kinds of classes to talk about the work experience. It's one of those areas where if you view the prison from the outside, it looks like a pretty spooky place, and part of the goal is to sort of demystify that. A lot of tours are done, not only tours of the legislative body and their staff and other people, but we do tours for a number of college classes and other sorts of groups to sort of open up that environment and show people what's there. So we're aggressive in our recruitment section. We do that in both traditional and non-traditional ways, sort of targeting the areas where we think we'll find people who are interested This work gets more complex, more difficult, requires more skill, knowledge, and education as time goes on, and trying to do that through a structured environment like a college campus is one of the ways. In terms of people with color, again, both traditional and non-traditional roles, consultation with people who sort of know how to go about doing this. Again, I think that's probably, though, more than not, an area where word of mouth plays a big part in that. And as we build more institutions on the east side of the state, which will be the case, or in the rural parts of this state, our ability to attract African-American officers and employees in the DOC is probably going to become more difficult. Our ability to attract Hispanic or other officers, we have some opportunities there, but it's going to be a difficult area, and I think the fact that we've met the target and to a degree exceeded that is a big compliment to our superintendents, our HR staff, and other people who have kind of dealt with those issues. But we continue to, I think, to struggle, and most public safety agencies in this state in the more rural areas struggle with that as a challenge. In terms of disabilities, I don't have a good answer. I think that there are physical requirements which preclude people from working in those areas currently. There are potentially waiver opportunities and other things, but those are very rare. So the ability to attract people with disabilities is really looking at the support kinds of functions or areas where they may not have direct responsibility to control and move inmates like a correctional officer would. And that's guided by DPSST standards and other statute.
Thank you. Thank you. Chair.
Well, Mr. Chair. Representative Leonard.
Thank you. Dave, I am concerned about some information that I've gotten, I don't know if other committee members have as well, of women COs, and particularly apparently at the Snake River Institution, that have had issues in terms of relationships with the prison population that has caused a number of them to be terminated. And the concern that I have is what kind of training does the department have for women COs to deal with those kinds of issues? And to be more clear, apparently some of the women COs have had inappropriate relationships with the male population, and I'm just wondering how it is, I mean, how there are 19 of them to be terminated. And I'm just wondering what the department is doing to respond to that in terms of training so that, if you know what I'm trying to say,
I mean,
there are different issues for women COs and there would be men COs in dealing with the prison population. I would imagine some of the population can be very charming and manipulative, and I'm just wondering how that's woven into training for women COs. Are there different things that they're, different kinds of tools that they're given to deal with those issues and men?
Chair Miller, Senator, Representative Leonard, it really starts with the selection process and how effective we are in getting the right people into the work that we do. And that's been a focus of our recruitment unit and HR, our superintendents and others for some period of time. I don't think we're there yet. I don't think we have as good a recruitment process as we might be able to have, but being much better at that requires significantly more money to invest in psychological testing and other things that I think can get at that. We do some of that today. I'm not sure we do as much as we can do, but it's an area we're continuing to explore. Rapid growth, and this is in no way an excuse for this, but rapid growth plays a part in this. Snake River and other institutions on the east side. This is no criticism whatsoever of the employees that we've recruited there, but we made a commitment when we put institutions around this state that we would hire somewhere in the neighborhood of 70% of our new employees from the local level, from the local environment. And we've recruited far and wide at Snake River and it's true at Two Rivers as well, trying to find appropriate employees. Now, once they're our responsibility, they're trained through the DPSST system that we cooperate with, they're trained on-site generally there. Part of that training is around inmate manipulation, how to deal with inmate behavior.
Excuse me, Dave. Is that specific to the women's
No, it is not.
For
no,
both?
It's for both genders. And I think that that you're absolutely right, that our problems have been unlike a lot of states where it's generally the male COs who are preying upon female offenders or being in the same way charmed by them and find themselves terminated or prosecuted for that. And our experience in Oregon has generally been that male offenders are manipulating the females, particularly brand new employees. A lot of that has to do with supervision and training. We've improved in that area. We've consulted with the National Institute of Corrections, which has a specific training piece around sexual manipulation of staff, preventing that from occurring. There are a couple of pieces of work being done in the DOC. I think that's going to be a continuing problem as we grow, as we continue to hire more new correctional officers. We're working on improving our training and mentorship of those employees, but it's one of those pieces that requires pretty much constant vigilance to ensure that somebody who may be very good at all aspects of their job is also good about realizing when they're being sucked into a situation that they don't recognize until it's too late.
Right.
And lots of promises, lots of commitments and things are being made, and people are vulnerable, and our people are no less vulnerable than anybody else out in the community for this kind of thing, and in some ways are much more so because we're dealing with the cream of the crop in terms of expert manipulators.
Right. If I could follow that up. And so you've recognized that problem. You're taking steps then to enhance training and recruitment techniques to address that issue.
Representative Leonard, I think we're taking steps. I'm not certain that it's the end of the problems and that there couldn't be more concentration in that area. But one of the things we've recognized, as you recognize in the fire service, is there's probably more training that comes along than you've got time to do.
Right.
And it's one of those focuses. And whether it's focusing on how to reduce assaults or how to avoid manipulation or how to detect mental illness issues or other things, we're trying to enhance the training, trying to balance that with work requirements and our ability to budget that. But one of the focuses has been on the manipulation of staff by inmates.
If I could ask one more. I'm also concerned about some of the issues of sexual harassment to some of the female COs. Can you talk about that and where we are there and what steps you're taking to deal with those issues?
Again, are you speaking specifically of Snake River?
Yes.
We're working on that. We are engaged with I'm slipping a cog right now on that, but we're working with some folks to deal with those issues. Can I get back to you on that when I can get more specific information instead of trying to dredge up through my memory?
Sure.
But I know that it's...
But I'd like to talk about it here.
Yes.
Because I just want to just make a personal comment. I just... There's just something about those kinds of issues, and whether it's dealing with the NRA or anytime I perceive somebody as a bully, it just brings out the worst in me, and I really feel strongly that if we're having an issue with people in powerful positions using that power against weaker people, whether they be weaker in terms of physical capabilities or in terms of their responsibilities, and there's nothing that rubs me more wrong, and I suspect you're much the same way.
We have the issue. We clearly have the issue. We will continue to have the issue. We should be disciplining, terminating, doing whatever is necessary to bring it to the attention of people who behave in that fashion. We have done some of that. I don't know that particular culture at Snake River is any more promoting of that kind of behavior than anyplace else in the department. I know the superintendent, his staff, supervisors are aware of it, know that it needs to be dealt with. I know that the female employees there, and we're engaged in that specifically around bully complaints and other things now. We've got legal proceedings in that particular area. But as far as strategies to address it, that's been in existence for the 6 years I've been in the Department of Corrections. And yet, I guess I'm never surprised when it pops up again in places. And again, you refocus your efforts on what it is about the behavior of people like that you need to identify and deal with.
But you can bring back
we some can, information. We can. Discussing here, I think, is a good point. We will do that.
Right.
Just in your training, is it emphasized that there's kind of a zero tolerance of that
Chair Miller?
No, up front.
Senator Tro, I don't know that in the training that's true, but in the policies and the procedures of the Department of Corrections, it certainly is true. And specifically in the training, I can't tell you it's addressed in that way. It's addressed through our in-services and other areas with our employees. The initial training, I don't know the answer to that. Senator Miller, I'm essentially ready to conclude with two final points. One is that we have the document that I believe you have requested or will request around our span of control within the agency, our span of supervisory control. That ratio, and I can give you the ratio backed up by reams of material that we'll provide to you and you can wade through, is a ratio of 1 to 8.5 supervisors to staff. And then in addition to that, I want to make just a brief comment, if I can, about staffing standards. We have been directed to deal with and work with the unions and others around staffing of our institutions. We've been doing that for more than a year. We continue to work on it. It has been one of the more challenging projects, I think, within DOC in terms of looking at how do you array staff around this organization in these institutions. Every one of the institutions you see on the board there is different. There isn't a one of them that looks like another one. And the closest that we'll come to that is Two Rivers and Coffee Creek and Madras. And as we move into the future, they'll look more alike and they will look dissimilar. But physical situations, length of service of staff, skill and training, a number of other types of things influence that. So we continue to work on it. I think we can get there. We may not all ever agree that this is the perfect formula or the perfect system, but there is no good model nationwide. There is nobody in this business that has a staffing standard. You can pull off a shelf and say, when you run a medium custody institution of this age with this kind of infrastructure and these types of inmates, this is the way you array your staff. It does not exist. And so we're working on that. We're working across the department with lots and lots of folks internally to have their input to it. And we will at some point have what we believe is the standard. We will propose that to you and the executive branch and get a determination about whether we're on target or not, and move forward with that as we build out into the future and as how we array our staff in the institutions we currently operate.
Thank you very much. Questions? All right. Thank you.
Just that as we go through the various institution divisions, budget units, we'll talk about standard control information that they're going to provide you just so you can have that background. One thing I didn't mention in my opening comments is that the governor's budget for corrections also undergoes a revision based on the forecast. And so you'll hear in some of the presentations talk about the governor's recommended budget and the governor's revised budget. We're going to try and hold off as much of that discussion of the governor's revised budget as we can till late in the presentation. But just know that the forecast does change the bed needs. It was generally downward, and there are some reductions in the budget that are allowed through that. And we'll talk specifically about the impact of the revised forecast probably on the third or fourth day.
Bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Bill McGee from the Department of Administrative Services. Got my separate handout here. On page 2, as Larry indicated, the general fund budget for the Department of Corrections is $863.3 million. That's a 13% increase from the legislatively adopted budget, but a 7% decrease from current service level. The total budget of $1,017,000,000 is a 1.4% reduction from legislatively adopted and a 5.1% increase from current service level. as Larry indicated, the largest portion of this budget is in general fund, about 85%. Other funds, 14%. The primary source of those funds is certificates of participation to support the construction program. In addition, there's inmate welfare funds involved. There's some charges for services for inmate work crews and sales of products from the workforce development program. There's federal money that's used for construction in lieu of COPs for one project. There are transfers from the Department of Education and community colleges to support the education programs. And there's federal residential substance abuse treatment program funds that are transferred from the Department of State Police. And the federal funds piece of this budget, 1%, is the State Criminal Alien Assistance Program revenues. Moving on to page 4 to just...
Sure.
Senator Trow.
With regard to the inmate welfare funds, is there a different use of those funds so that some of the drug and alcohol treatment program is being paid for out of those funds?
Mr. Chair, those funds are used to support activities that assist the inmates. I believe there's a...
I'm sorry, Bill. I wasn't paying attention.
I believe some of those funds do support some of the correctional programs, such as alcohol. Yes.
Okay. And that's a different departure than has usually been the case, or is it just a greater using of them at a greater extent?
Mr. Chair, Senator Trow, the use, I think, is pretty much the same. We're continuing to use those funds for those purposes to the extent that
they're available. Some figures that indicate that there's an acceleration, at least, in using those funds.
There'll be some additional inmate welfare funds as the population increases. I think that perhaps is what you're thinking of.
Okay.
Page 4, I summarize the governor's recommended budget. It opens all beds at the Coffee Creek Correction Facility in the Washington County area, and all remaining beds to Rivers Correctional Institution in Umatilla and the Snake River Correctional Institution in Ontario. At the opening of the Coffee Creek facility, it converts the Women's Correctional Center in Salem into a men's minimum custody facility. The budget funds the October 2000 Community Corrections Population Forecast using new rates for the Senate Bill 1145 program, as were authorized by the 99 legislature, and it establishes a pilot therapeutic visiting program serving incarcerated parents and their children at two institutions. The recommended budget also eliminates or reduces inmate activities at 7 institutions. It eliminates morning exercise yards at all institutions. As Dave indicated, it implements the Inmate Management and Transition Services Program that targets correctional programs in specific institutions. Under IMATS, programs such as alcohol and drug treatment, mental health treatment, education, health, and volunteer services will be eliminated or reduced in some institutions, and the inmates will be housed in institutions that best meet their needs according to what's determined during the intake process or other evaluation and indicating the incarceration and treatment plans for the inmates. The recommended budget eliminates positions in institutions, programs, administration, central services. It funds construction of new facilities in Lakeview and Madras, expansion of an existing minimum custody institution, and various other capital projects in existing facilities.
Yes,
Senator Crow.
With regard to some of these cuts that have been made, reallocations perhaps from one thing to another, those are mostly made because there's just not enough general fund to go around. Is that the problem? Because it would seem to me that some of these reductions in inmate programs, inmate activities, and so forth, increase could possibly pose some problems for the institutions.
Mr. Chair, Senator Trow, I think we'll spend some time talking to you about that when we go through the divisional details. But these particular issues were reductions that were made because of the shortfall in general fund to support the budget.
Okay. Regrettably made.
Yes.
Okay. Let me just ask one more. Speaking of enough general fund to go around, could you tell me on your fourth check, establishes pilot therapeutic visiting program, what is the price tag of that?
That's $320,000 for that program. It's a small pilot at Coffee Creek and the Columbia River Correctional Institution to do some parent training and some supervised visitation between inmates and their children.
That's the total cost of everything associated with that program is $320,000?
For the therapeutic visiting, we have a transition package that has some other elements, as we'll talk about shortly. But the visiting program itself is the $320,000.
The total package, though, is what?
The total transition package is, just check and get the right number for you.
Yes.
Get there in a minute.
Is that the $1.8 million?
Yeah, that's $1.8 million. In addition to the therapeutic visiting program, there's an upgrade to the department's incarceration and transition information system to better help them deal with transition issues. And there are two positions to establish program managers for the overall transition efforts. The of that $1.8 million, the visiting is the $320,000.
Okay. Thank you.
Then I'll move on to page 6 and very quickly summarize the governor's March 2000 revised budget. His recommendation was to increase general fund for the department by $6.8 million to backfill a shortfall in the state criminal alien assistance program that's been reduced at the federal level, to upgrade the department's central computer processor, fund the community corrections outcome population that was incorrectly not funded in the governor's recommended budget, to correct another error in the amount of funding recommended for the Attorney General cost, and to anticipate population changes occurring in pending legislation, such as the assault bill that Dave mentioned earlier. Beyond the governor's revised budget, there are issues to raise to you from the April 2000 forecast and a refinancing of some certificates of participation. Specifically, there is $6.9 million in reductions from the budget because of the forecast changes and the refinancing of the COPs. We'll talk about that in a little more detail in a moment, but the department will, as it moves forward, will discuss its priorities with you for reinvesting those funds. The governor will be reviewing the May economic forecast and other statewide issues before making any recommendations on use of the funds. That's an overview. I'll just move ahead again, and as Dave indicated, and looking at page 7 now, a number of program units we'll be talking to you about. The largest is the institution's budget. That's about 42% of the budget. Correctional programs, 10.7%. Community corrections, 19.1%. Those would be the largest pieces.
Representative Leonard.
If I could just ask you, for an example, institution's budget, the 42%, I notice you have another slice of pie for administration at 3.2. Are there administrative positions within the 42%?
Ms. Chair, Representative Leonard, there are management positions at each of the institutions up to and including the superintendent of those.
But that's not included in the administration.
That's not included in the administration. The administration is the overall administration for the entire department.
So in that 42% slice of the pie, could we get some idea what percentage of those are management or administrative positions?
Mr. Chair, I think the information you have received or will receive on span of control will give you that in great detail.
I've got that. I do, and it's probably too much detail. It's probably why I'm asking, because I'm going through that looking, and I'm looking for, about four steps further back than that.
We will summarize that for you as we move through the divisions, if that works. But we'll provide
looking of the 42%. How much, just in terms of a percentage, is that management supervisory? Okay.
Senator Brown?
This is non-related to Representative Leonard. Is that okay?
Sure.
Okay.
That's even better.
talk to me about community corrections and the budgetary relationship to what we did with the counties in terms of Senate Bill 1145, and are we meeting our obligations to the counties under 1145? Is that part of this piece here?
Ms. Chair, so they were asking you to answer.
I just know where he is.
Oh, I know where I am. Ms. Chair, Senator Brown, we'll go through the detail and when we get to community corrections grants. But to summarize for you, the budget for community corrections grants is established by determining the projected population. The Office of Economic Analysis and Department of Administrative Services does a forecast of the population for Senate Bill 1145, probation, post-prison supervision. So the budget funds that forecast. at the levels per day and per month levels that were, have been approved by the legislature in the past, including an increase in the 1145 rates that was approved by the 1999 legislature. After the counties did a review of what their actual cost of management was, and those new rates were adopted for, I believe, 9 or 10 months in this biennium, and they're fully phased in for 24 months in 0103. And the rates are inflated based on the general inflation factor that's used in the budget. So within that, our belief would be that we have fully funded the community corrections program, given legislative direction and how that program is to be supported.
Mr. Chair, follow-up. Would the counties tell me the same thing?
Mr. Chair, Senator Brown, probably not.
Okay, thank you.
Some particular counties would definitely not tell you the same thing. There really are two issues, I think, here. One is whether the overall level of funding is appropriate, and there are specific details here. Are we making right assumptions about the percentage of 1145 offenders that are in prison as opposed to being managed elsewhere? There is another issue that's outside of the overall funding level, and that's how the funds are allocated among the counties. And I think a lot of the issues that are raised are raised regarding allocation, particularly since counties that have high cost of managing offenders, such as Multnomah County, when the rates are averaged, have some difficulty because their costs are higher. So you're seeing two issues. How, is the pot big enough, and how is the pot being allocated? And we'll talk a lot about that when we get to that division, I'm sure.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think we've heard those issues before in different contexts.
So, anyway, Mr. Chair, I was on page 7 going through the program units. And again, we have this 5.4% for central support and operations. Debt service is about 10% of this budget. Capital improvement is 0.2%, and capital construction is about 9.3%.
Can I ask one more question about your
Representative plan? Leonard.
So central and support operations as opposed to administration would be, would that be like the warehouse with the...
That would be part of that. That's human resources. It's the budget, the contracts office. It's the information systems unit, the warehouse distribution. The construction management program is in that as well.
And then community corrections?
Those are the grants that we were just talking about that go to the counties.
Those
are,
Chair.
Senator Trout.
Has the percentage for correctional programs decreased because of the centralization and of those programs?
Mr. Chair, the amount has decreased. I don't know if the share has decreased. I would suspect that it probably has. But we'll have to ask to get you to...
I'm a little concerned about what we're doing with some of those programs. The drug and alcohol program... I'm not sure it's going to be available as it has been before, and the educational program, we're talking about problems of drug-addicted people who need help. We're also talking about kids, people who need some education, need to learn to read, master some literacy problems and things. And so I'm just wondering, you know, if we're sort of neglecting that side of it.
I suspect we'll talk in more detail when we present you actually the details of the budget. Moving on to page 8, to give you an indication of where the dollars are spent in this agency, 44% are personal services, 16% service and supplies, 11% capital outlay, as I said, 10% debt service, and 19.4% special payments, which is primarily the grants to the counties for community corrections. So I'll move on to page 9 and walk you through how the governor's budget was developed, beginning first with emergency boards through April 2000. There are two issues here, the salary adjustment you've seen in most budgets, and other funds expenditure limitation increase for a Senate Bill 1145 construction project in Klamath County. Current service level budget adjustments agency-wise, the position and standard inflationary changes you've seen in all budgets, the standard state government service charge adjustments, again, you've seen. And through the governor's recommended, at least through the current service level, we are basing our funding on the October 2000 prison population forecast. So you'll see that throughout. As we indicated, there were some changes resulting from the April 2001 forecast. The first program unit that we haven't really talked about, the inmate work programs, that is in fact eliminated in current service level as the department transitions the Prison Industries program to Oregon's Corrections Enterprises, which was established last session as a semi-independent state agency. The inmate work crews is responsibility and funding and positions are transferred to the Institutions Division, and the Workforce Development Program are transferred to the Correctional Programs Division.
Chair.
Representative Doyle.
Thank you. On the Corrections Enterprises being transferred to semi-independent status, can you go through the, is there any revenue now coming from OCE to general fund or coming in? I guess comes in as other funds, but I mean, how? What's the relationship? I guess since it's semi-independent with this other state agency.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dole, as a semi-independent state agency, and there are other examples, the Oregon Corrections Enterprises is outside of executive and budgetary control. Right. So, in essence, it's not on our budget. The direction was for the OCE to be able to support itself and put offenders to work. As Dave indicated, that there's quite a challenge in being able to generate the dollars to do that. And so there is no transfer back from OCE into the general fund or to department operations. Its intent is to support itself and find opportunities to comply with Measure 17 for the work requirement.
Okay, so then, somebody coming in here momentarily. Is it using state property to... I guess for the work that's being performed,
and sure, Dole, it is a state agency, so it's any property that's using generally is state property. There is use of facilities, Oregon State Penitentiary for metalwork, furniture factory, the laundries is in the institutions. I mean, a lot of the work for security reasons you do keep inside the institutions, most of it. So.
And to follow then is that then. I guess is now OCE being charged for any of that? I guess using that from the department. I mean, is there any kind of correlation there? That
Mr. Chair, that is an ongoing. The relationship there is developing. I think over time we're moving to a situation where OCE will be more self-supporting in issues like that. There are some problems. For example, the utility metering at the institutions doesn't really lend itself to separately identifying. Say energy costs for the different parts of the facility. So we're looking at that. There is an intent to make OCE work, and if we were to overly charge it at this point, we'd find a good way of sinking it quickly. So if you want to...
I'd be happy to add more if I can help in any way, but it is a transition, Chair Miller, Representative Doyle. It is a transition process. We believe that ultimately OCE has to be, as it says it will be, independent and operate in a profitable way. The main customer for OCE, though, is the Department of Corrections in many respects, laundry, blue jeans, and other kinds of things. So the opportunity for us to ratchet up costs on both sides is certainly there, and probably to the disservice of taxpayers ultimately. So our goal is to... move about this slowly. I have responsibility for both of these agencies, and to at some point have appropriate costs paid by DOC, appropriate responsibilities for OCE, but it's a fledgling, as has been said a couple of times, it's a fledgling enterprise, and what it essentially does is engage in the process of making profit by competing in the private sector for the most part, but it employs DOC inmates. The workforce is DOC. And so we find ourselves more in compliance with ballot measure 17 by ensuring that our inmates are working. If we strangle this operation, then we reduce our compliance. That has consequences as well. So this dance is going slowly, and I think we'll get there ultimately, but not all costs are probably currently equitably shared.
Follow on that, then, your comment about how one of the missions is to compete with the private sector. Is it just for those private sector services that supply Department of Corrections, or is there other private sector competition out there where they're out competing, I guess, by supplying others besides Department of Corrections?
Chair Miller, Representative Doyle, yes, outside the DOC. We are the primary customer, but we're certainly not the only customer. And we are in, for example, private partnerships with an example that's probably fairly notable is the Array Corporation, which actually manages and operates the Blue Jean, the Prison Blues factory at the Pendleton shop. And so they are engaged in competition essentially all over the world in the manufacture and production and sales of those jeans. We purchase product from them as well because our inmates are clad in denim. And so that is part of their sales, but certainly not in the future the only sales. We compete openly for jobs to manufacture metal products. We compete to provide sanding equipment and other things, plows for ODOT. We provide metal products to other counties for jail beds and things of that nature in competition with others. We're in a number of areas like that. We're most competitive in the laundry business, least competitive in the furniture business and things of that nature.
Okay, so then I guess the final question is, so part of your being competitive is then that you're not having to account for the full cost, I guess, that those in private business have to account for in overhead, that kind of things.
Chair Miller, Representative Doyle, that is a raging debate over whether or not we do, because the private sector has no responsibility to manage offenders in an environment where people are going to be hurt if they walk off the job with a piece of metal or do other things. So we hire staff who have to do that supervision. That's a cost of doing business for OCE. So there are people who will argue that we are unfair competitors and others who will say that we pay our costs. And we have a constitutional requirement under Ballot Measure 17 to compete in the private sector. And we have done that, and we have, in fact, done it without a significant amount of vocal concern from out in the environment, although there are several places where people are pretty vocal. The Oregon Nurserymen's Association, for example, and several others have raised the question of whether or not we're unfair competition. And I have a responsibility to consider that when we compete and then make a determination about whether we will or will not compete in that area.
You mentioned the nurserymen's. How do you respond to their concerns?
Chair Miller, Representative Doyle, we've actually responded in a couple of ways. We are selling a product which is essentially indigenous species to the parks and people like that. State agencies also have an obligation under Ballot Measure 17 to comply with the Constitution. And so that's an area where we think it's proper for us to compete with the private sector in that area to lower the cost of government, which we do. They don't see it the same way we see it, obviously, and we've also asked to consider whether or not they'd like to enter into a private partnership with us. We will be a labor force for them. We will broker labor. One of the big problems those folks have is trying to find a steady, consistent, trained labor pool, and we can provide that. So if people are creative about how they work with us, they can succeed, I think, in this area. Not everybody wants to work collaboratively with the Department of Corrections and use inmates as their employees, but we can do both an inside and outside operation, the existing existing inmates, and then the future back to the community citizens have opportunities for employment in both those locations. It is growing. I think the opportunities are increasing, but there are people who would rather stomp us out of business than let us compete, and I have to consider that, but I'm inclined to believe that we are legitimate competitors, and as such, we should continue to try to fulfill our obligation to the Constitution.
Mr. Chair.
But it sounds like you're kind of sold on your program, and people who may think that it's unfair competition get to appeal to you as to whether or not you are, and at least catching the drift of this conversation doesn't sound like you're going to be too sympathetic with somebody who challenges that assumption.
Well, Chair Miller, I think I'm sympathetic in certain areas, but I think also what people are asking for, we're members of, and I don't know if this is the right place to raise all this, we're members of this Nurserymen's Association. We are no different than, in my mind, and I know they disagree, than any major competitor that enters the marketplace and potentially puts others at risk. If we have If we are unfair in our competition, we've tried to find ourselves putting inmates to work in niche areas that primarily serve state government, not even local government, because they have no obligation to do ballot measure 17, primarily to serve state government and agencies like that. I'm not beyond determining that we should not be in a particular business, but we're primarily approaching from a profitability standpoint, and we're trying to be guided by what we believe statute and constitution tell us to do. And on one hand, voters want this process, and on the other hand, they don't want to be competed with in their particular area. And it's a very, I think it's a tough road to walk, and we're trying to walk it in a way that I don't think, for the most part, legislators have heard a tremendous amount of angst over this issue, and if they had, I think we'd be having a different conversation. Probably you would give us more guidance, but we've tried to take the guidance you've given us and implement what we think you're asking us to do.
In the situation where somebody does challenge your decision, I mean, it's pretty much is there some appellate review of your decision, or do they come to us as some have and simply say you got to get them out of this area?
Now, I think, quite frankly, Chair Miller, that the path is to your door.
Great.
I didn't, not intentionally, sir, but I think that's the result of it, is that there is no oversight board or anything that exists.
Yeah, you're the big cheese.
Yeah, you get to work me over, they come to you.
Well, but I mean, in terms of us not being in this process, it kind of ends with you.
Well, and as Bill points out, there's certainly always the governor as well they can speak to on it, and I don't know where various groups are. But again, the nurserymen is a good example of an area where we're continuing to sort of try to work through this. For the most part, our other areas have not had tremendous concerns.
Go ahead. I thought there was another question down here.
My question was just, are we going to be talking about this later as part of a presentation? You have a new arrangement now in terms of the way we're doing this, right? Before basically it had been part of corrections. Now it's sort of separated from corrections. It's its own kind of private corporation with the head of corrections being the CEO. Is that how it works?
Chair Miller, Senator Trow, that's in essence the way
we do that by legislation fairly recently.
Yes.
And yeah,
last session.
Was that legislation that you initiated or legislation that we initiated?
I'm not sure it was jointly initiated.
So we've got our fingers on it as well as you folks perhaps having. Did we put everything there? Didn't we used to have a dairy? Do we still have a dairy?
Chair Miller, Senator Trow,
no, it's gone.
There are several things we don't have any longer because they were not real profitable. They were historically interesting and culturally, right, you know, invested, but they're not making any money.
But we had it for years, didn't we?
We had
long before your time.
Long before.
Competing with everybody, but providing us with dairy products, some of which were good.
We milked it for everything we could.
Right, we did.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Chairman Miller. I understand you do have a balancing act in trying to determine what is the appropriate role for the state to play in regards to ballot measure 17. But I have a question in how you determine what businesses to enter. Philosophically, is it appropriate for the state of Oregon to be in a business that produces or even glorifies clothing being worn by convicted felons, and that is the prison blues?
Chair Miller, Representative Smith, that's an interesting problem, and I agree with you that there is potential for it to be glorified. When I first came to the department, I would say that the marketing effort was all about glorification, creating a situation in which the inmate culture was portrayed to people out in the community as being something, you know, that they should glom onto and wear a pair. We've modified that. We produce a quality, much more quality product than we ever did before. We really promoted around the idea that, I should say, the private partner in DOC OCE promoted around the notion that it is inmate work people are paying in some way their debts for that, because part of their pay is retained for cost of care and things of that nature. We don't advertise it as any kind of glorification, but more of an obligation for inmates to work and produce products, and we compete in that area in probably one of the most competitive environments in the world, the clothing business. And we don't do it because we don't know a heck of a lot about the clothing business. We're in partnership with somebody else who does, and we are essentially
specifically,
labor brokers.
Specifically, we spend millions of dollars on trying to deter our youth from participating in criminal activity. And then on the other hand, we're in a business that kids can go and wear clothes that promote life in prison. And I'm not sure that's the right message the state should be sending. Perhaps that's a discussion for another day.
Senator Brown.
My recollection is that prior to ballot measure 17, DOC had about 30 to 50% of the inmates working at least half of the time. Now we're up at about 80%, so we've doubled our percentage, or almost doubled our percentage, or we increased our percentage from 50 to 80%. At the same time, we're certainly encroaching on private enterprise and other public works. I know that there were some Vincent DePaul programs that were impacted by DOC projects. I guess my question for you is, has it been worth it?
Chair Miller, Senator Brown, 1995, when I came, I probably spent the first couple of weeks hearing people tell me that this couldn't happen, it couldn't be done, shouldn't happen, it's bad public policy, etc. But voters decided that it should be done, and so we were going to implement it. I had my reservations about whether it made sense, and I still have some reservations about the way that it's crafted. But I would say, on the whole, the value in teaching inmates work ethic, the value in teaching people to know how to find a job and hold a job when they are released, makes it worth it. Now, whether or not we would have been arrayed in the same way, or whether we would have done it the same way, whether compliance would have been the same, I suppose could be debated. But the department, frankly, pre-95, pre-94, drug its heels on trying to do some things in this area, and they got delivered a message, and we implemented that. Representative Smith and other people, Representative Doyle and yourself, and I know, have concerns about specific ways in which it's going about being implemented. But on the whole, I think people are relatively pleased with it. On the whole, I think we're doing what we've been asked to do. And on the whole, I think it's a very good program. Would I ask for another program just like that to be implemented, you know, with a sort of a mandate? I would not certainly want that, because I think it stifles our ability to be creative in here and to sort of work around some of the issues. But it has been implemented, and I think it's done some things for inmates that are beneficial. And that'll be borne out by future looks at recidivism and some other things, I think, as inmates, or the, you know, the economy plays a major role in that, and I think Oregon's doing a good job with it.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm on page 10 in the discussion of how the governor's budget was developed and our service level adjustments. And the items on page 10 that involve the four operations program units for the department are all related to the opening of the Coffee Creek Correctional Facility. First of all, of course, the operating costs to actually run the beds in that facility for the biennium as it's phased in. Secondly, the conversion of women's beds to men's beds at the Oregon Women's Correctional Center, the Columbia River Correctional Institution, and Eastern Oregon Correctional Institution. Funding for rental beds for women between July 2001 and September 2001, when Coffee Creek is available, that's about 35 or 40 beds over a three-month period. Transfer of the existing intake center to Clackamas County, as was envisioned when Senate Bill 1145 passed. That was, we were to return that facility to them once we have our own a new intake center. That will actually occur this biennium. And finally, the phase out of costs to maintain the physical plan at the Danvers State Hospital prior to its return to the mental health division.
Where's Coffee Creek located?
That's on the Day Road site in Tualatin.
Bill, the House is having a call right now. Lewis and Clark, or one of them's in the building. Lewis.
I hope you're not being condescending.
No.
I didn't dress like this.
I understand they're both there.
To try to make Representative Hansen feel more comfortable. Purpose to this.
I thought you were pushing the prison blues. So I had to suspend this, but we'll pick it up right here at page 11, or where we are again tomorrow when we convene. And we'll say, we'll be back here at 8:30, and appreciate your presentation today. With that, we are adjourned.